This is the Popmatic Podcast for October 1st, 2014. Much to the chagrin of our parents, we get artistic. We're actually all too old to worry about what our parents think, but this is still the Popmatic Podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. Joining me today are...
Bill.
Mike.
Amanda.
And I'm Brian. We are getting artistic today because October is Arttober here in Nashville. There will be every kind of artistic event all over the city and at all the library branches. I'll put a link in the show notes to all the things that are happening at the library and all the things that are happening all over the city. Seriously, the page that the city made this year for Arttober is awesome and has links to so many events. It's like, oh, I want to go to like all this stuff. But we're going to indulge ourselves today with the best books, movies, and music that have anything to do with the arts. Arttober. Amanda, I heard you have an interest in art.
I do. I like art a lot. I think a lot of people think that art is visual and like you picture people painting and coloring. But music is also a part of the arts. It's my favorite part of the arts, if I'm honest. So the book I'm going to talk about today is called Play It Again. It's by Alan Roosbridger. He is the editor of The Guardian, which apparently is some big paper in the UK. I don't know. I'm not a UK paper aficionado, so I'll just take him at face value with that. But he called himself an amateur pianist. I would even say a hobbyist. He had taken piano a little bit when he was little, and he decides to tackle Chopin's Ballade No. 1 in G minor, which is, a lot of the book he claims it's one of the hardest pieces of music ever written. I don't give him that. It is challenging. It would take me a little bit of work to play. I read through it, and it is hard. I'm not sure it's the hardest piece ever written. So anyway, he decides to set out to tackle this piece as an amateur, and he wants to learn it in a year. And it's only a 9-minute or so piece. It's not like a big Beethoven sonata, but there are tricky passages. And for those of you who don't know, Chopin is he's the only composer that wrote for piano on every piece of music he ever wrote. Like everybody else has choral works or instrumental works or symphony works, but Chopin always wrote for piano, like maybe piano with something, but always piano in his brief lifespan. He's definitely the piano master, and he's one of my favorite composers. I played several of his nocturnes and several of his etudes, and I do love him. But he is one that as a performer, you have to make it sound easy when the notes are very challenging, because there's a lot of repetition of melody, but then he always changes it a little. Like he'll flat something one time, or he'll change where the thirds go, or he'll change the pattern. So as a performer, you have to know, okay, which time through is this, what changes, what stays the same. And that's part of the reason that Chopin is hard. The other reason this piece is really hard is it's just fast. The end has big jumps and leaps and octaves, and it's just pretty much as fast as you can possibly play it, which always makes things challenging. So in the meantime, so Russ Bridger sets himself this goal, but in the meantime, you know, his day job as editor for The Guardian, he has to deal with all the WikiLeaks story, the tsunami goes through, you know, the European Union financial system basically collapses. And so he's still working, you know, 12 to 14 hour days. He's traveling to India and, you know, all around the world. And so he's trying to fit time into his schedule to learn this piece of music. And with piano practicing, if you don't play, you lose it. Even, you know, you could work for 2 weeks and then you don't play for 2 days and half of what you learned is gone. So it is very challenging. His goal is always to do 20 minutes a day, like first thing in the morning, which is good because that's when your brain is the freshest. So he goes through and he's working on it. More of the book than I'd like is about his day job as the editor. And I'm like, I don't care about that. What are you doing with the piano? But so in the end, he does come back. He plays the Ballade on a concert. And I liked what he said about it. He said, you know, professional musicians are required to learn pieces of music basically to perfection. They can play with it a little bit, but they need to get those notes. They need to get all the expression. And he said, as an amateur, it's more of his job to tell a story, which I liked, because I think that so many times we judge musicians, oh, they played 2 wrong notes, or she didn't play this, you know, the forte, or, you know, whatever. So I like that he was focused on telling a story and making it musical as opposed to trying to do something technically perfect. And he's still kind of trying to, like the epilogue said, he's still kind of trying. He's never played a note perfect, and I hate to tell him, I've never played something note perfect. but it's how you express yourself and how you make it musical that really counts. So I thought it was interesting. I like the ballade. It's a nice piece. Chopin does dark very well, and it's in G minor, so it's in a dark key. But I doubt that I will be putting in a year towards the ballade. I could probably do it in 6 months if I really set my mind to it. But
oh, take that!
Bring it. That's right. I went to IU. I got this. Maybe at some point I'll go back and pick it up. But it is a nice piece, and this is an interesting book to kind of get a different perspective from somebody who didn't grow up in piano land like I did. So that was Play It Again by Alan Rusbridger. All right, Mr. Mike, what's artistic in your world?
Today I've got a documentary called Finding Vivian Maier. So sometimes I like to watch not just one or two, but three or four movies in a day. Haha. Most of the time, it doesn't turn out that great, but earlier this year, I saw four fantastic movies in one day. Pretty cool. First was Milius, a documentary on John Milius. Next was The Raid 2, which is kind of like The Godfather, but a dude's jaw gets ripped off in the first 20 minutes, which is super awesome. And then Under the Skin, which I already talked about in the Medieval Times episode. And finally, a documentary called Finding Vivian Maier. Maier was a nanny who secretly took over 100,000 photographs throughout her life, mainly like street photography of people. While walking through the city, but she also took, like, landscapes and that kind of thing. It's kind of theorized that she chose to be a nanny so she could have free time to, like, look around the cities and or take the children on walks. There's, like, these anecdotes from the now-grown-up children where they're like, yeah, we walked through the, like, scary area of town a bunch of times. Nothing ever happened, but, you know, it was scary. None of these photos were actually shown or published within her lifetime. And even when asked about it, a lot of her friends and her acquaintances denied knowing that she was ever into photography. After she died, trunks full of negatives were put on auction. I think it was kind of like a Storage Wars kind of deal. Anyway, many of which were bought by a guy named John Maloof, who's like a professional picker kind of guy. And figuring out the provenance of these negatives, he went on a search to find out who she was. And it was like a backwards thing. It's not like it said, hi, I'm Vivian Maier on the side of it. Anyway, personally, I felt a real kinship with her, especially there's a story where she is trying to talk to an old friend, but she comes across as way too shy or nervous. I am a tall, socially awkward weirdo as well. So, like, you know, I felt like a kinship. Yeah. And after the film, I checked out and or bought a bunch of books on photography as an art form, because I always kind of considered art photography as a kind of a record of life and less of like an artistic thing, really, especially the surrealist photography of Man Ray. He's an interesting dude.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like the rayographs and things.
Adolescent hero of mine.
As with all documentaries, I would also, you know, check up on the interwebs to see, like, you know, if they're completely authentic or take, you know, the other side or that kind of thing. I read some interesting critiques on whether the filmmakers either accentuated her eccentricities to, like, make it more interesting, her life more interesting to sell more photographs, because it turns out that Maloof is also one of the directors of the film, the guy who discovered it. Or they even may have played up her eccentricities to reinforce the notion that a woman who chooses to live alone and never marry is a crazy nutcase. We have some books of her photographs as well. I just checked out one called Eye to Eye, Photographs by Vivian Maier.
Finding Vivian Maier is like doing what, for photography, what Helvetica did for, like, design. Yeah. And I think that is good. That is an awesome thing. Art form that's everywhere, people are like aren't paying attention to. Like, I think a lot of people are paying attention to it now, and that is awesome. And the way that, like, you were thinking about photography and getting photography books, a lot of people have had the experience, I think, after seeing that movie. That's really inspired a lot of people, and that's great. I mean, that's why we do Arttober, right?
And she worked for Phil Donahue.
Yes, that anecdote is awesome. Yeah. I love that. My jaw dropped. I was like, what? She was my nanny. What about it? What have you got, Bill?
I was in college when I first heard of the artist Jackson Pollock, or as he's called in the art world, or there was an article Kurt Vonnegut wrote about him in Esquire some years ago called Jack the Dripper. Mm-hmm. I was taking a course in art that included paintings, music, film. The class was more about modern art, and I became immediately interested in Mr. Pollock and how he brought, or as the teacher said, brought an American sensibility to art. He was born in Cody, Wyoming, and he died in an automobile accident, like other American artists, like James Dean and Bessie Smith. Jackson Pollock would lay his canvas on the floor. Instead of brushes, he would sometimes use sticks. He would get his paints not from an art store, but Sears and Roebuck. And Jackson Pollock would try to capture inner turmoil, and believe me, there was a lot of inner turmoil with Jackson Pollock. Just recently, he's very much part of pop culture. It's just kind of ironic. I went to see the movie A Walk in the Tombstones, with Liam Neeson. Highly recommend it. Liam Neeson makes, now I'm paraphrasing this, I don't remember the exact dialogue. He said, "Oh yeah, you're the guy who did the Jackson Pollock in the men's room at New York Central." So you automatically knew what he was talking about. He had a unique way of saying, he said himself he wanted his paintings to live. And instead of talking more about him, let me recommend Pollock, this 2000 motion picture that stars and is directed by Ed Harris. Marissa Gay Harden won her Oscar, well-deserved Oscar, for his wife Lee Krasner.
Jackson Pollock, I'm Lee Krasner. I thought I knew all the abstract artists in New York, and I don't know Jackson Pollock.
What do you think of Picasso?
It has been.
De Kooning.
He's all right. He's learning.
What's she doing here?
You need to get cleaned up.
I have just climbed up and down five flights of stairs. I'm Peggy Guggenheim.
They're sorry.
My God, and you're drunk.
No.
No.
What you're doing is the most original and vigorous art in the country.
We're broke.
You just keep at it.
I'm keeping at it. Don't tell me to keep at it.
You've done it, Pollock. You've cracked it wide open.
Genius. Jackson broke the ice.
I don't think you realize how hard I work to get people interested in you.
Let's make a baby.
The vows don't stipulate baby.
I'll be dead without her.
But I'm the one who loves you, Jackson.
If you don't stop seeing her, I'm going to leave you.
You open that mouth again, I'll kill you!
You are killing me! You are killing me! You are killing me! Oh.
Stop playing with me. How do you respond to some of your critics? They have said a mop of tangled hair, cathartic disintegration, degenerate. What do you say to that?
People would just look at the paintings. I don't think they'd have any trouble enjoying them. It's like looking at a bed of flowers. You don't tear your hair out over what it means.
How do you know when you're finished with a painting?
How do you know when you're finished making love? The world keeps turning.
We also have several other AV materials, but the one I'm most familiar with that we have, there's a book that's called Jackson Pollock, Energy Made Visible by B.H. Friedman. Those are the two that I'm recommending, the 2000 motion picture that stars Ed Harris as Jackson Pollock, and there's the book Jackson Pollock, Energy Made Visible by B.H. Friedman.
Well, I feel like that there are Jackson, that they may be on YouTube, like he, like toward the end of his career, like he would paint on glass, and he would film from underneath so you could watch him like paint.
Oh, cool.
And I feel like those are like public domain, they're instant. So
there's a YouTube, there's a whole 50-minute documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Melvin Bragg, it might have been part of the South Bank
like
show.
Toward the end.
And they show that, where he's signing his name, Jackson Pollock. It's kind of funny. I always said, well, anybody could do that. Well, no.
He's the one that did. I mean, that's always
he brought abstract expressionism to America and kind of blew everything out. But he could draw because if you go back, you can find
early stuff.
Yeah, it was realistic. Mm-hmm. But he found a way to express the inner turmoil. And I went to the New York Museum of Modern Art and saw one of his. And I just, sat down. There was a chair in front of it. I just said, well, I might as well take this in. Just kind of fascinating, both the man and the art.
Well, I love, too, on his, because he was a smoker, and so, like, half the time they say you can see, like he would stand over his painting so the ash would fall on the paint, and, like, would just make it part of the painting.
Yeah.
So even if it's all monochromatic, like all black or all, with a little red or all white or whatever, like you could, it's like textured.
There's gray spots.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot more to his painting than he didn't just throw paint on a canvas. There's actually thought behind it. Yeah, I like Pollock too.
I just remember when that movie came out, speaking of shy awkwardness, this girl asked me if I'd seen it yet. And I said, no, I'm waiting to go see it with my mother. You know, a day later, I was like, I think she was asking me on a date.
And I
told her that I was going to go see the movie with my mother. So, that's the memory of that movie for me. All right. I wanted to talk about a novel called The Drowning Girl. And, Mike, if you're going to do horror stuff, dark stuff, the whole way through October, I'm throwing down right now with The Drowning Girl.
Oh, snap.
2013 Bram Stoker Best Novel Award winner.
Ooh.
Boom. So, what The Drowning Girl... The Drowning Girl is by Caitlin Kiernan. I should give the author some credit, I guess.
You put a little work in, you know.
I thought this was the Brian show. So it concerns India Morgan Phelps, or Imp, to her friends. She's a painter and a fiction writer. She works part-time at the art store. She lives alone in the apartment where her aunt and mother both committed suicide. Now, she has inherited their mental illness. She's a very unreliable narrator. And she gets into this whirlwind relationship with the girl that she just picks up off the street that she doesn't know, and they end up living together and forming this relationship. And the relationship lasts from July to November. But also in July and November, Imp starts to be visited by this ghost. And the first time she meets the ghost, it's in the form of a mermaid. And the second time she meets the ghost, it's in the form of a werewolf.
Ooh.
The werewolf ghost comes in November. The mermaid ghost comes in July. Are you confused yet? So what's interesting, though, the story is told from Imp's perspective, as if she's writing the story, but also her therapist has told her, you need to write out the problems that you have. So she gets time all confused, and maybe she is mentally ill and doesn't want to tell the truth. But also, the werewolf and the mermaid appear to Imp in paintings, like in the sort of real life of the story. But then also she writes about werewolf sculptures and mermaid paintings within the fiction, within the story. So within the story, her therapist will be like, maybe you should write a story about what happened between you and your girlfriend. So then she'll write a story about, and it's like, which characters are who? But then also the entire book is filled with all this folklore and real facts and made up facts about werewolves and mermaids. Mm-hmm. And it's all mixed all together. And you all get confused about what's real and what's not. And who's who, and is what the mermaid represents seduction, because the mermaid's really a siren, but the werewolf represents rape and murder. Are they the two characters? Are they the two girls? Actually, it's transfixing. It's like trance-inducing. Like every time you think you have it figured out, like what time something is happening or what period something is happening, there's like another layer to the onion, but I'm not sure if it's a layer on the inside of the onion or outside there of the onion. It was just a great book to start reading in fall because it's interesting. It starts in summer, but for me, it's just the perfect fall book. It just has that mood. And I do know how it ends, but I just can't, or how this resolves itself, but I can't explain it at all without spoilers.
No spoilers.
You know, and one of the things that I'm kind of, that fascinates me is like this book was published by Rock Fantasy, and it's clearly like, not a piece of genre fiction. It's a more like an avant-garde literary novel, but like she didn't have a place to publish it, maybe. Mm. And I love when weird art doesn't fit anywhere else ends up in the commercial channels of genre. It's like, here's something that's bizarre and doesn't fit, and then it ends up somewhere else or ends up having this whole other life of its own. And I think that's what's happening with The Drowning Girl.
Has she published other stuff?
I've heard of her. I forget exactly.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard her name, but I don't know if it was in relation to that or if it was...
She published a book called The Red Tree, which was also very popular, and a lot of other books.
Yeah, she's mostly a genre writer, though. That may be why they lumped it in.
Yes. A lot of people felt like maybe she was always sort of going in this direction, and she didn't have enough clout to just, this is the book I want to write.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
But, you know, getting, I think The Red Tree got nominated for some awards and sold a lot. And then she was able to do this more experimental novel that will melt your mind.
The Werewolf and the Mermaid sounds like an English pub. I would totally drink there.
Yes.
So if you want to have a nightmare that you can't wake up from, I'd recommend The Drowning Girl. I wish Clint was here because he would appreciate my Kenneth Anger references, but also I think he would disagree with me about my next point. That is that I think that you should be able to interpret art however you want or within whatever context you want. And I'm totally okay with the right of the artist to say, well, I wish it was presented this way. And the ideal way, as far as I'm concerned, the ideal way you should interpret art is this way, like in a theater with this sound set up or this color scheme, or you need to sit in front of this painting quietly, or not, you know, that kind of thing. In the course of this book, I actually lost this book. And then so I stopped reading it. And then I found it again and started reading it again. And I was totally confused which of the characters were fictional and which were like real within the book.
Ooh. Cool.
And that added this whole other layer to, like, what this book was about.
Yeah.
And it was like, that's just so perfect.
Yeah.
And I love that there was, like, just, like, that circumstance. Then it was, like, even within the context of the book, the way everything is so slippy and you're not sure what's real and which characters are fictional and which are not and, like, which are dreams and which are real. You notice I kind of have a thing with the art I like, the stories I like, this whole dream thing, what's real, what's not, what's dreams, what's not. And I was just like, well, maybe that happened on purpose, right, that this book got lost, then I found it again, and I'm confused because that's kind of one of the themes of the story. And then I look at the spine, and the book was cataloged on my birthday, and I was like, oh,
wow.
I was like, get out of my head.
It's haunting you.
Yeah.
Book was totally haunting me. A book about a haunting totally haunted me.
I like these avant-garde horror things. That's what House of Leaves was. You know, it could be a lot of things. They shelved it in the horror section. And I've also seen it in the fiction section. It ends in a very, like, uplifting, not very scary sort of way.
I mean, there is a conclusion to the book, and, like, I don't know if that helps the book.
Oh, okay.
Right? There is, like, an ending.
Sometimes I don't mind that as much in horror. And sometimes it just makes me mad. It's like, you know, you cut it off, like, a page before it ends. And it's like, why? What happened? You know.
I get mad. I'm like, what was the point? Like, I'm no better off than where I started.
Yeah.
You know, you go through all that struggle, and then you're just like...
But within horror, I think one of the ideas is to make it horrible. So it's like you don't get to wake up from the nightmare.
Yeah.
So the idea is that
they don't want it to have that.
So there's no resolution, right?
Yeah.
You're stuck. Right? Like, you know, in Freddy, when you're like,
I've never seen Freddy.
This is the idea of, like, I woke up, Freddy.
Yeah, everything's totally fine.
Everything's Freddy. No, I'm still in a dream! Freddy's still here!
Right, yeah. Run away!
Like, that principle. Mm. And I think that's why that's, like a trope in the horror genre. Now, some people, not acceptable, right? Does not work. Does not compute, mm-hmm. right? Like, you just broke the machine with that one, man. But...
Sometimes I'm into it. Sometimes I just get mad. It depends on what it is. Depends on the thing, you know, the journey that I went through.
If it's a horror, like a scary horror, like horribleness, where horrible things are happening to people's bodies, that's the kind of ending I want. Because if it all wraps up happy, I'm like, what was this? Isn't what the theme of this was, mm-hmm. or aesthetically what this was? It's like a U-turn.
So, like at the end of Saw, if they all went to Disneyland together, it wouldn't.
Yes, doesn't make sense.
That may be more of a torture than some of the things that they go through soon.
Fair
in
enough.
Saw. Welcome, listeners, to the first entry in Shocktober. So, I thought I would juxtapose my talk from The Colony last week with another book that I read for last year's Shocktober Shockstravaganza Shock. A book called House of Windows by John Langan. While The Colony is gloriously trashy, this one is more like... reads more like literary fiction. It's very smart, brainy. In a way.
Art.
Yeah, it's very autistic. In a way I really liked it, but even now I'm not 100% sure what happened. You know, just FYI. House of Windows tells the story of a writer who is cornered at a party. I always assumed that it was John Langan himself as an homage to, like, you know, old-timey, like, 19th century fiction where, like, the author is being told a story by, like, you know, somebody else. He's cornered at a party by an old acquaintance named Veronica. She tells him a long tale, which is the bulk of the book, about what happened to her and her husband at Belvedere House. Not Mr. Belvedere, the 80s sitcom that you 80s kids may remember. That was pretty cool. Her husband, Roger, was an English professor who specialized in Dickens. Essentially, the gist of the book is that he cursed his son, Ted, with this, like, elaborate, like, you know, I will never see you again. You are dead to me. I have no son, kind of thing. And he said it in a spooky voice, too. Why do you say it in a spooky voice? And then Ted subsequently dies in Afghanistan. Roger is racked with guilt and feels personally responsible for his son's death. Soon, Ted comes to haunt the couple at their house, but only Veronicans can see him. And originally, he starts to, like, look like he did in life, but as the book progresses, he looks more rotted and haunted. It gets a little bit more complicated because the house itself isn't really haunted. It's more like there's an H.P. Lovecraft story called, has something with Witch House in it, Tales from the Witch House or something.
Dreams of the Witch House.
Dreams of the Witch House, yes. Which is about non-Euclidean geometry summoning things. And I think it's a similar kind of deal where, like, the house is built weird and that's why things are coming through. And a lot of the first half of the book is the backstory of both Veronica and Roger, which is pretty interesting. There's a theme of, like, father and son relationships throughout the book. I didn't know. I've never been a father. I don't know, like, you know, there's a certain kind of hope that you have when you have a son. And both Roger and his father were both terrible fathers in different ways. There's also a lot of it's about the strain of a May-December romance because Veronica is in her 20s and her husband Roger's in his 60s. Hoo-boy. I quite liked it. I thought it was really cool. Although, like with food, I tend not to savor books, so I kind of got the vibe that I read it a little too quickly and that then let it kind of, like, you know, permeate and think about the themes and things.
I had the opposite experience with The Drowning Girl.
Yeah.
And that made the book so much better.
Yeah. I feel bad about that sometimes. Like, you know, there are some people, again, House of Leaves, like, there are people who took 6 months to read it. I read it in 3 days. So, like, you know, they'll whip out, like, you know, what you did? You missed the symbolism on page 132 about, like, you know, the march through the Philippines or something, and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, I guess that happened. House of Windows by John Langan. That was pretty cool. You should check it out.
Throw it to Bill.
What do you got, Bill?
Tickling my fancy, I mentioned I went to see Walk Among the Tombstones. Really enjoyed it. I already mentioned that they mentioned Pollock, but it's interesting, the drug dealer in the movie reads Nabokov.
Mm.
And it's just these little interesting touches in the movie. And well, it gave me a hankering for more New York crime dramas, and we have in our collection King of New York, written by Nicholas St. John and directed by Abel Ferrara. The cast is pretty amazing. Not only Christopher Walken, but you have David Caruso, Lawrence Fishburne, Wesley Snipes, Giancarlo Esposito, Paul Calderon, Steve Buscemi. What's amazing, with the exception of Walker, these were early roles for these actors. They were not well known yet.
Frank White is a free man.
How come you never came to see me?
Who wanted to see you in a cage, man?
He served his time.
What can we expect from the reformed Frank White?
I want to be mayor.
He paid his debt.
Go someplace where you can stay out of trouble.
But some things don't change.
From here on, nothing goes down unless I'm involved. No blackjack, no dope deals, no nothing. I've been waiting years for this.
I know what you're up to, White. Forget it. I'm going to make you and your friends disappear long before that.
Are you arresting me?
Frank's Park Avenue attorney can get him out in 10 minutes. 10 minutes later!
I feel no remorse.
I missed you.
I got a $250,000 contract on anyone involved in this case.
The cops tried to stop him their way.
I'm not your problem. I'm just a businessman.
Now they'll have to do it his way.
There's only one way to get Frank.
Christopher Walken, King of New York.
You expected to get away with killing all these people?
I never killed anybody that didn't deserve it.
The film came out in 1990, but I didn't see it at a theater. Oddly enough, I saw it at a mom-and-pop video store in Springfield, Tennessee, and that's how I discovered this film. Supposedly, I didn't realize this. The film was so... When they showed it at festivals, at one time Nicholas St. John and Lawrence Fishburne were booed off the stage. It was so reviled, which I don't understand. Maybe it's, you know, you were still kind of in this John Hughes era, and here's this in-your-face 1990, but really should have been 1970s crime film. The film, like I said, has a hard edge to it. And just one little interesting note, Paul Calderon made a film here in Nashville called The Last Castle, and he used to come to the library a lot and got to talk to him. It's funny, Lou said, two of my favorite films, Miss 45 and King of New York, and Calderon kind of stood back. I said, whoa.
Yeah.
You know those films? You know, he thought they were just not outside. But anyway, we do have King of New York in our collection. Once I said, hard-edged crime film, but I highly recommend it.
Do you want to tell the audience who Lou is?
Oh, that's right. Lou is a co-worker of mine. He's now retired.
Love me some 70s crime dramas. Here, yeah. Check this out.
The one movie I'm looking forward to the most that's probably coming out in the next year or two is Ferrara's Pasolini biopic with Willem Dafoe as Pier Paolo Pasolini.
Yeah, they're showing that in Venice.
Cannot wait.
So go see King of New York. Amanda, what's tickling your fancy?
So after last week's podcast, when Brian talked about Little Brother, I went online to see, you know, download it or whatever. I think it sounds interesting. He's talked about it 84 times, so
Twice. Maybe twice years apart.
I don't do math. So anyway, so
24 times a piece.
Yeah, that's right. So I went online and I found it, and there was an ad on the download site. You could get Little Brother on a poster, like the whole book on a poster. And so I'm like, well, that sounds cool. So I clicked on it, and it turns out there's this company that puts books onto, you can get a poster, you can get a t-shirt,
I've heard
you can get a tote bag. And it's called, it's litographs.com, LITOGRAPHS.com. Not lithograph. I did that wrong. And you get like stuff by Matisse and all that if you do lithograph, litograph. And so I was looking through, and they are really cool. You can do Anna Karenina, you can do Crime and Punishment, they've got Dream Psychology, Leaves of Grass, they even have Isaac Newton's Optics.
They have the Divine Comedy, and each part of the Divine Comedy looks like heaven, hell, and purgatory. Mm-hmm. Looks very cool.
Yeah, some of them are really cool. Now, so they have all of these classic books, and then they have Little Brother. Like, that seems to be the only really contemporary book that they have. Mm. There's only like maybe 20 or 25 books on the site. And I am depressed because Gone with the Wind was not one of them. I'm like, I would get an extra large shirt. It's okay. There's, you know, plenty. And some of them are, I was looking to see, maybe it's too long, but there are some of them that are longer.
I bet you it's a public domain thing.
It could be.
Yeah,
because they're older. So anyway, so if you have people in your family that like classic books, your Christmas shopping is done.
Yeah.
And they all have little designs on like a picture. There's not just words on a shirt forever.
Yeah, it's
and
words
ever.
On a shirt, but they form a design that's about that book.
Yeah, like the Anna Breen Gable
really
one.
Cool.
She has like little braids down the side.
And if you, they have like a little micro or magnifying glass. So, I mean, you can, on the website, so you can do like a close-up. Because from far away, it just looks like a design. Uh-huh. When you go up close,
like
it's all made of words.
You can kinda,
it's very cool. Yeah.
They are really cool. So, litographs.com.
Corrections. Oh my. Library gods. There's so many corrections. This is just be the correction show.
Oh man.
Woo-hoo. And I don't think any of them were mine, really. Maybe.
Uh-oh.
Maybe one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Maybe one. Maybe one.
Richard Ramirez or whatever.
Bill's super excited about two new Lewis Black titles in God We Rust and Stark Raving Black. He said they were DVDs, but actually, at least according to the catalog, they're audio CDs. And are they audio CDs?
No, I took them home and watched them.
They're DVDs.
They're DVDs.
So there's a mistake.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, no.
In the icons in our catalog. That happens sometimes.
I thought they were DVDs,
too. I'll look that up.
Sometimes people find VHS and Blu-ray in the catalog. Sometimes this happens.
It's magic.
Just a follow-up. The large format illustrated edition of Animal Farm that you mentioned was illustrated by Ralph Steadman. And I link to that, and I bring it up because Ralph Steadman is an illustrator who's most closely associated with
Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay.
And I just thought about this, too. This is a blow to my ego that within the context of this show, Hunter S. Thompson is associated with Mike.
Hi.
But Philip K. Dick is associated with me.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I'm mad about that. Okay.
Hey, I like Philip K. Dick, too.
I mean, I got Sandra Bullock, so you know. <All right. laughs> Trade these.
I can't think of it, but while we're on Ralph Steadman, I saw a great documentary earlier this year about Ralph Steadman.
We got a giant coffee table book by him. That title escapes me, so I guess you
I believe it's Too Weird to Be Normal.
Yeah,
Too Normal to Be Weird.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, if you click on the link in the show notes for last week, it's the first item that comes up. Okay, the book that we were the Nabokov incomplete novel. It's actually a completely different novel. It doesn't have anything to do with Lolita. Mm-hmm. And the title is The Original of Laura.
Okay.
We still have one copy, and certain parts of it can be removed by, like, punching them out board game style.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just ask if you check that out.
Please don't do that.
Follow Wheaton's Law. And, Mike, you had a correction, right?
Yes, it turns out that I mentioned at least a couple of times last week that A.J. Colucci was male. It turns out it is the lady who lives in New York City and has a husband.
Interesting.
Cool.
That's a major mistake.
Well,
you
I think
want to come up before now.
I think the biography in the book, like, you know, and the colony just mentioned that A.J. Colucci is a writer who lives in New York, so I was being sexist and assumed it was a guy, so you could totally blame me.
Perhaps the genre fiction world is sexist, and herself or her agent might have been like, listen, if you are gender neutral,
maybe there's a better chance that your giant ant book will have more appeal.
Yeah, I checked out her second book recently, which involves the a group of people who go to a cabin and discover the secret language of plants. They chat with plants who then kill them.
The plants kill them or they kill the plants?
Plants kill them, because apparently if you talk to a tree, it's going to want to get all stabby.
Well, we saw that in The Wizard of Oz. Yeah,
that's right. Don't pick my apples.
Uh-huh. The Day of the Triffids.
Yeah.
John Wyndham.
Yeah. Good book. Check it out.
I had mentioned that Brooke Candy's video for her song Opulence probably owes a thing or two to Kenneth Anger, in particular his inauguration of the Pleasure Dome. But I've since learned that there's this little like narrative, you know, piece at the beginning of the video, and that's a direct quote from a scene from Samuel Fuller's The Naked Kiss, which is an old noir movie that,
ooh,
you know, Mike and Bill could probably make some popcorn and enjoy together. And the library might get it because it's on Criterion, so maybe we can get a copy of The Naked Kiss. For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
O-R-G, and our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
All right.
Need a minute? Are you okay?
All right. I shouldn't laugh my own joke that much.
So what totally destroys the podcast? Poop joke. pubic hair jokes.
Right. Enemy.
Okay. Yeah. Totally off.
We're all adults here.
20 minutes in, we're stuck on the pubic library joke, which is funny because that's an old one.
Yeah. It's ancient, but still fun.